pleasure to chair a Q&A with you at the Amnesty International lecture. Isn't that extraordinary? I had to keep telling myself all the way through that, as you were negotiating your way through Europe, I would find it more difficult to get through some airports on my own, that you were doing all this at the age of 13. And you're saying, I must go find my brother, and I find someone related to your brother. You didn't have a map, you didn't have a phone. You know, you parachuted into various parts of Europe as a 12-year-old and doing all of that. No wonder you feel like you're 45 when the refugee service talked to you. I mean, how did you manage that?
Great. There's a very interesting quote up. Is this thing working? I think it is. Einstein, and the famous scientist, and he says that he fears, because of technology, we will have a generation of idiots, you know? I feel like that idiot. But seriously, like, when we rely so much on technology, we fail, you know, we fail. But when I didn't have no technology, I think, yes, I had agents and smugglers and all those people who were supportive. But, like, after Greece, I was on my own. I had to make my own decision. I had to find my own way. And I think, I don't know, my upbringing really helped in my faith, and I continued. I thought everything was happening for a reason, and there was a bigger goal at the end. And again, I reflect back on my life, and I think if things has worked out the way I wanted to work out, for example, if I was accepted as a child, taken into foster family in Kent, I wouldn't be sitting here now. I would be a completely different person. Mm. I know people who have went through that route. But because of the hardship and the struggles that I had to face in Britain, made me a better person. And I think sometime in life, we should appreciate things the way it is. Sometimes we don't know, you know, how the outcome could be very useful for us. But I don't know how I manage. If I had to make the journey again, I wouldn't be able to.
Really?
Yeah.
What's your legal status now? I know you got your refugee status.
That is what it is, yeah.
That's it.
And yeah, residency to be a refugee after, like, you know, after a long battle,
yeah,
to be accepted as one.
And they recognize your Afghan citizenship?
Yes, of course they have. Eventually, I went to the Afghan embassy to get a birth certificate and a passport. And then they were like, great, but if you want to be a refugee, then you shouldn't be going back to your embassy. And I was like, how else am I supposed to prove that I'm an Afghan? So it was just the
catch 22.
That's the word.
Do you think you might become a British citizen at some point?
Hopefully, by about 4 or 5 years' time. I think one of the privileges that you guys have, British citizens have, is that as soon as you are born, you are able to go to 172 countries without visa. And I think there's an inherent injustice in the world system. And I think if we have a fair system in the world, then people will come to Britain and Europe in a civilized way, with visas. But, like, for example, I was born in Afghanistan. It's not my fault. It's just an accident of birth. And I'm actually quite proud born in Afghanistan. Yeah. Quite patriotic. But I'm only able to go to, like, 28 countries that I haven't even heard the name of. So the system has to change. And I think I hope to be an Afghan and British citizen. But now I used to be very nationalist. I used to be this little extremist and fundamentalist, you know. The West was, like, bad and infidel. Things was black and white. But I've learned. I saw the world from the outside, and I've learned more. And I feel like I'm a global citizen. And I think we don't need British or Afghans or whatever. We need global citizens. And I think that there's less of us. And we need more people to think globally.
How do you feel about the Taliban now?
I think my views on the Taliban... I mean, recently they have been doing actually really, really bad things. Like taking over northern Afghanistan and civilian casualties. But I have problems. It's not that because of my family involvement. I want to be as neutral as I can be. Those people who are fighting against the Russians, and I don't want to get too political, I've been told not to be too political, to talk about the broken story rather than being political, but I think it's important because those who are fighting, including my father, who are fighting against the Russians, they were freedom fighters. And those who are fighting against America and the West, the 50 countries involved, are somehow terrorists. It's a bit hard for me to understand. However, I think there's no place for the Taliban in the Afghan society in the current form. If they want to become part of society and they want to govern, they have to do it through democratic means and should stand for election and people vote for them. I mean, we have, like, the Afghan parliament is full of idiots and stupid people. They could join them. It's great. If people vote for them, now, honestly, people can vote for them, they could go. But my views have changed.
Yeah. I knew you were going to say that. You've said, I mean, I asked you about this on the radio today, because you have said you'd love to be the president of Afghanistan one day. I have absolutely no doubt after that talk you probably will be, but, I mean, how would that happen? Would you make your way back to Afghanistan at some point, get involved in politics there? What is the future plan?
I think I have yet to meet a refugee who says they don't want to go back to their country. I mean, home is always home, and I think one thing we have this struggle with, like, oh, these people are coming here, they're invading our countries and taking our jobs and all this, honestly not a very realistic arguments. But for me,
yeah.
I don't want to go back home. I do miss home. I miss Afghanistan. Britain is my second home, and I love Britain. It's not that I don't. I actually usually wear a British flag, but I lost it somewhere in my bag.
Probably why. I'm not committing myself to anything. But
yeah, I hope
just
to go
never
back.
Know.
I hope
know.
To go back. And yeah. I think because when I've been studying and doing all the things that I've been doing, all of my political activism and engagement in campaignings,
yeah.
I just want to be, you know, I just don't want to be negative. I want to have this positive ambition that, you know, I want to be in the position of leadership where I will be able to change things. But it doesn't really matter, even if I don't become president, if I'm in a position where I can bring peace and I can use my experiences and expertise and the things that I have learned in Britain, which is I have learned a great deal and I'm still learning,
yeah.
would be very useful. And I think I definitely want to be one of the added to the list of the Manchester University graduate who is a world leader. by 2030, I will be running for office. There's a plan.
When was the last time you chatted to your mom?
I spoke to my mom last week. It's hard. When I talk to her, I don't want to talk to her. But then, I get really busy with especially with the book and doing a lot of events and stuff. But there's very little understanding between us. I told you today and on the show as well, I told her that, Mom, I've written a book and I dedicated it to you. And she's like, wait, you have far too much time on your hand. Why would you write a book and share your story with me? She doesn't really understand all the things that I'm doing. She thinks she just wants me kind of to study and stay safe and don't become a bad guy, I guess. But other than that, it's recently actually, sadly, my little sister passed away. And it made me feel, you know, the sacrifice that I'm making, is it worth it? You know, I was not there. I wish I was there to see her at the end. And it's like 9 years. She was a child when I was living. I think her picture is in the book as well, which I didn't even realize until recently that her picture was in the book. So then it just makes me feel that my grandma passed away. I was not there. She was, as I said, she was the most important person to me in the world. And there was a time when she used to tell me that, Gulwali, we should go to grave together. And that's how much this is how much love we had with each other. But sadly, I was not there. And my brother got married. I was not there. My sister got married. I was not there. So suddenly, this, you know, being safe, there is a huge opportunity cost. So there's huge, I don't know, it's hard to describe. It's a difficult feelings inside that there's a conflict within me, whether it's worth it or not. But I think, I hope it is.
How do you feel when you hear this big political and cultural debate happening in Britain today and in Ireland and other parts of Europe about asylum seekers and refugees and about whether it's appropriate for so many people to come into European countries? And we are talking about particularly Syrian refugees at this point, not just Syrian refugees.
Great. I think the problem is there's misleading. There's lack of information. The fact is Britain is 23rd in the world for taking refugees. One in 10 refugees are in Europe. The 9 of them are not in Europe. The 10 top countries which take refugees are developing countries, countries like Pakistan, Jordan, and elsewhere. Like, I think I've mentioned this to you today as well. Lebanon is a small country. Have 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 people are Syrian refugees. And literally Germany has actually taken more asylum applications this year so far than Britain has done in the last 10 years. It's really hard to get to Britain. I think there's this minority people kind of pushing for this agenda. There's more people coming. No, there is not. There's very, like, 4,000 people in Cali. There's, like, less than 1% of the people who are entering Europe. And people does want to go. They want to go to a place where they get safety. But I think Britain has this special reputation in the world about, I mean, one of the things people want to come to Britain is the language, as well as there's a cultural link or historical link. But also, one really important point is that they see they will be treated fairly and they will be treated justly, which is great. And, like, they have seen the cruelty in Europe. And also, this Dublin regulation is very unfair. Like, now I actually hopefully will change, but the first EU country that you enter, you should claim asylum. And now I realize why Greece wanted me to leave and why Italy was so hard for me to move on. Because the rest of Europe doesn't help them. Because if every refugee or asylum seeker comes to Spain and Italy and Greece, and the rest of Europe is happy. It's like, Dublin regulation, you handle it and you deal with it. No, I think it's unfair. And I think Britain could do more, should do more, and it should take the lead. And I think it's actually damaging its reputation the way it's been acting. And historically, Britain has been a place, you know, of welcome. Look, we saw the Jewish being escaping persecution in Germany, and they were welcomed. If they weren't welcome in Britain, then we would have seen the consequences of that. And I think right now, the debate shouldn't be about money and cost and protecting borders, but it should be about protecting those people and giving them safety. And then we'll think about long-term, which is finding solution to Syrian peace and as well as Afghanistan.
Well, can you imagine 20,000 talentless people like this flooding into our country? I mean, our economy would collapse, wouldn't it, with that lack of intelligence? Let's go to you. We've got some questions from the audience. We've got some mics as well, haven't we, if we need them. Otherwise, you can speak fairly loud. Oh, Patrick's rushing to a microphone. That's Patrick Corrigan, everyone, former ballet dancer, now director of Amnesty International. So anybody got a question? Anywhere on the story, on the refugee issue, on the politics, the culture of it, just put your hand up and we'll come to you.
That's the best part of the discussion.
This is the good bit, when they all wake up. We've got a question over here. Keep the hands coming up so we can see where you are. I'll come to you in a second. Yeah.
Hello, great. Thanks very much for coming, and thanks for your contribution. I look forward to reading your book. I read your article in The Guardian yesterday, which was very interesting. You talk quite a bit about Calais today, and you talk about it in the article. And I mean, here and across the water, as we say in England, so Calais is kind of blown about to proportion. And really, when you think of the numbers of people coming across into Greece and into Hungary and so on, you think of the size of Calais. I mean, it could be solved pretty quickly, couldn't it, if the will, political will was there? And I wonder if that was the impression you got when you spent your time there, that, you know, this is not a massive problem. It could be solved quickly.
Indeed, thank you for your question. I think that's what we are forgetting. I think no one is really discussing Calais. I mean, I say, look, it's...
Do you want me to repeat that question?
No, just continue.
Oh, you can't hear me?
Oh, you can't hear me. Is this thing not working? I think it is working.
Let's see if we can turn up the mics.
Move it up to your lapel slightly.
That's okay. 1 second.
Is it better now? I still can't hear myself.
You can't hear yourself either.
Okay, that's better.
Is that better?
Now? Thank you. So
could you hear any of the first half hour? Oh, we're going to have to start again. If that's all right, go on. Okay, go on. How would you do Calais differently?
I think when David Cameron says he wants to take 20,000 Syrian refugees, I kind of see this as a joke, but it's a good step in the right direction. It's something. But this Calais issue is that needs to be resolved. It plays between two world capitals, and people are living in a very inhumane conditions. I went there and I saw it. Literally, all they said, they said, look, we don't want anything. We don't want your clothes. We don't want your food. I visited twice recently. All we want is to be treated as humans. And we are escaping wars and conflicts. And here we are, stranded in this jungle, in this place, a tiny place. I think it's 4,000. It should be distributed across Europe. And this place should be closed for once and for good and for all. And it can be done. But I think there is no political will. The UK has spent 16 to something million pound on building fences and blocking, sending security rather than kind of helping those people to... Because I think it's a lost generation. There's a lot. I saw young Afghans, like 8, 7. And it just... Literally, I couldn't help but to cry. I'm quite strong. I don't cry. Anyone in the book... Yeah. My writer, when we were writing, she's like, Gulwali, you cried. I was like, no, I didn't cry. She's like, you were 12 years old. I was like, yes, but I was an Afghan 12 years old. Mm. But literally, I went back and I think, you know, something could happen. Something needs to happen. It's winter is coming. And the charities can't really do very much, and the governments are literally washing their hands of any responsibility. But the great thing is actually, the British citizens or British people are going back every week or almost every day. Convoys are going back and taking foods and clothes and supplies, which is great. Mm. And it's at least something, I think, people-to-people relationship, because the government has failed them. And it's good that people are showing solidarity. And I have been disappointed with the response before about, like, why people are not responding. And then when I went to the welcome march in London, the welcome protest, it was amazing. Over 100,000 people on the street, ordinary people saying refugees are welcome. And it's a beautiful thing, and I think it shouldn't be about us and them. It should be more about loving and trying to be compassionate and caring. Those people really, really have left a miserable situation. I mean, no one wants to leave their homes. No one was coming from Syria before the war. And Syria was actually a place for safety for other refugees, the Iraqis, Palestinians, and Lebanese. And now there's only like 2 million or so are outside, who are 1 million or so that want to head for Europe. And I think we should, we have the resources, we have the means, but we just don't have the political will. And I think people could pressurize politicians to do more.
You mentioned Germany. I think Germany's taken as many people in this month as Britain is planning to do in the next 5 years, in the life term of this parliament. But people say Germany's different because Germany has this population issue where it wants a new population of workers, and it's after Syrians to come in, and pretty much advertise that fact, which is why a lot of people are heading to Germany. Britain has a different kind of political challenge where the issue of migration or immigration has become a massively important political problem here. So even if David Cameron wanted to take more in, he might not be able to do so.
And that's precisely my problem. I think it shouldn't be a political issue. It's about humanitarian. It's a humanitarian crisis. You should be dealing with it in a humane way. You should be dealing with compassion, in care, in love, as I keep mentioning. It shouldn't be, because, again, we should not wash our hands of responsibility. What happened in Libya, what we did in Afghanistan, what we did in Iraq. Now here we are. We can really show our leadership on this. And Angela Merkel, I actually really like her, but I think she's very clever. She's not only doing this because of the population thing, but she's doing it because she wants to show Europe how to lead an example, but also she can now tell European leaders, look, we are doing all we can. You guys need to take a fair share of this crisis or this burden or this investment or whatever you want to call them. But Germany can't really handle it. Far too many people are coming to Germany. And Britain is the fifth richest country in the world. It's not that we can't do it, but just we don't want to do it. And
How many do you think Britain could reasonably take?
To be honest, I don't want to put a number in it, but yeah. I think we could do, yeah, much more.
Just open the doors, or
No, of course not. It's the main issue is, I think, inequality in the world. You know, this injustice. People who are living in poverty in extreme circumstances and in oppressions. We call them, you know, economic migrants, but it is as bad as war. You know, poverty is as bad as war and starvation. So maybe we need to do more in developing countries, in war zones, to end conflicts, bring peace, and then provide jobs. I think people don't like to leave their countries, in their homes, in their families, if they're not faced with very extraordinary circumstances. In terms of how many we should take as many as we can and we could. And right now, at least the people in Calais or at least have worked with the European Union, with this share quarters and have share responsibility, take your fair share. Mm-hmm. And you can't just say, okay, it's nothing to do with us, you deal with it and it's your problem. It's a global crisis. I think Britain, recently when the Chinese president was here, I think David Cameron the first thing he should have said was, what is happening with the refugee crisis? China should be playing a part. If they can't take refugees, because China have the largest population, but they could actually help, you know, Lebanon, Turkey and Jordan to help those people there. And I think the issue I have with Angela Merkel is that Germany has announced yesterday they will send Afghan back. You're taking Syrians, but you're sending Afghans back. Why is this double standard? And Afghans have been refugees for the last 20 years and been drowning in the sea ever since. And it's hard. I mean, the Syrian issue is really important. I think it should be dealt with.
Anybody else? Yes, got a microphone here and there. Anybody up there? Just wave nice and high so I can see you. Good, thank you. You go ahead. Hi.
Do you not think that the churches of all denominations should be applying more pressure on the governments to bring
churches? Should churches be applying more pressure or doing more themselves?
I think churches are already doing some great work. When I went to Cali, I saw a church where it was distributing food and stuff. Even when I was there myself, I used to get clothes and food from the church, which was amazing. It was great help. And I mean, normal people, ordinary people could do so much. And one of the things we could do is, you know, writing to our MPs, pressurizing the government. I mean, David Cameron wasn't even willing to take that 20,000 in the 5 years, but because of public pressure, because of public opinion, because of the demonstrations and marches, he came to this. I think churches could do more, yeah. Religious institutions, universities, just normal people. We could all come together and say, look, you know, we should take more refugees, or we should at least, if we don't want to take refugees, we should at least help those countries who are taking refugees. Or at least, you know, work with Europe. I think, you know, Europe is 28 countries. Britain is isolating itself and it's not helping it, you know. And also this idea, because Britain is the hardest to get to, so people think it must be the best place, which it is, except the weather. But it's. I mean, you know, it has to be a fair solution. And the first solution is to work with Angela Merkel and the French and the rest. Like Hungary, for example, has been quite racist, closing its border and having fences. When Hungarian was once a refugee themselves to Austria. Mm-hmm. And Britain can't tell Hungary not to do that, because Britain has already doing that. Britain is leading in the wrong examples when it should be leading in the right examples through the UN Security Councils, through all the organizations that Britain is part of. Britain has huge influence in the world and it should use it.
And David Cameron says Britain has given more money than anybody else.
Which is good. I don't think it's enough. I mean, like.
But it's more than anybody else.
But that's good, but that's not good enough. Because Britain should be doing more, and also asking this. It makes me angry. Those Arab countries, those Gulf countries, they have money. They have literally have money. And they're not taking any refugees. Saudi, Qatar, Kuwait. Like, literally, David Cameron should be... Patrick Hammond was in Saudi somewhere. He should be saying, look, man, you promised to give some money. Give that, you have promised. They promised, but they don't deliver. And Britain should be after them, saying, you know, what happened?
What's your best guess about why they won't take any more refugees?
Who, the
or
Arabs?
Any, yes.
Because I was listening to this Quinty official. He said the Syrians are they're psychologically ill and they're mentally ill and we shouldn't take any. And they have caused problem in their own country. They would cause problem in our country too. But I think it's and they haven't even signed up to the refugee convention.
Yeah.
They're pretty racist. And this whole idea of, you know, the Islamic world or the Muslim world or the Muslim Ummah is supposed to be one body. We should be helping one another. But it's like they're the one fighting, they're killing people in Yemen. There's so two policies going on between Iran and Saudi, and they're not really focusing on... Everyone is flaming the conflict. Everyone is contributing to the problem rather than the solutions.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it, when you hear that from... Especially in the Christian West, when you hear people saying the Islamic world. Aren't they all the same? Shouldn't they just all help each other? Why wouldn't they want to help each other? But then look at all the quote-unquote Christian world. Look at America and Britain and Ireland and... Obviously, we're all the same. Obviously, we just think like that. We help each other. We don't harm each other. It doesn't seem to work that way.
Yeah, every religion teaches us to love one another, to help one another, but we are doing the opposite.
Yeah. We have another question, don't we, on this area here? Incidentally, Sunday night at 10 o'clock, BBC Two, my series on immigration to Canada. I only mention this because it's part of a series we're doing about migration from people here around the world. So we go coast to coast in Canada. And last year, we did New Zealand. And it's quite remarkable. People here are very proud of that migration story to Canada, America, Australia, New Zealand, other parts of the world. There are 2-3 million Britons right now living in other parts of continental Europe. And that's an economic migration story from here to other parts of the world. And it should be said as such. It should be named as such. It is. And we're proud of it because we help to make those countries great. Factor that into the current conversation about refugees. Go over there.
Hi. Yes, thanks very, very much, Gulwale. And this is on a different kind of tack to ask you. I think you mentioned about a foster family in Kent. Was that right?
In Bolton.
In Bolton?
I should have been fostered in Kent, but I wasn't. So.
Okay.
Everyone should be fostered.
I was fostered after 2 years. It was a great experience. I had that. It was the best time of my life.
So, looking at it from both your perspective and from the perspective of that foster family, do you think the family needed special skills or experience or understanding? And how was it for you as well? Because it's a particularly personal and intimate and kind of soft and maybe difficult relationship as well.
Great question.
Yeah. Very good question, yeah. I think I was hesitant. When I turned 16, my brother left me again. He went to Afghanistan. It was really complicated. There were some issues back home. And there I was, and Kent was telling me, Kent Social Services was like, you need to go to a foster family. And I was like, guys, you didn't put me in a foster family when I was supposed to be in a foster family. And by your standard, this is my second 16th birthday, so I don't need to go anywhere. Let me carry on with my life as usual. I was at school, my last year of school. But I'm glad I made the decision. This lady called Mrs. Brody, Chris Brody, she's my teacher at Starting Point. She became a good friend. Now I call her mom. Literally, I call her mommy. She doesn't like it, but... She's a wonderful person. She actually persuaded me to go and see this place. And I saw the place. And Sean and Karan, who are my foster parents, Sean was such a cool guy. And I really liked him, but I told him, look, I'm not coming. This place was in the middle of nowhere. It's a place called Lostock in Bolton. It's one of the poshest area. This is where Amir Khan lives, okay? It's a really nice place. But I still was not willing to go. But when I went, I think there was this willingness to engage. I think for me it was very strange. And it helped me to integrate into British society and... We had a lot of differences, especially on religion. I told him not to discuss religion with me because he said religion was the problem. Religion was the main problem to all the crises in the world and all the problems. And we learned so much from each other. And I still visit him. I visit him once a week or once a month, depending on my schedule. But I'd go after 2 years. I only lived with him for 2 years. But that 2 years really helped me my final year of school and first year of sixth form to do well with my studies as well as to do more for my activism and youth work and... So it was difficult, the cultural barriers, there was a lot of obstacles. For example, I give an example. I went one day to the kitchen and made tea for Auntie Karan. I call her Auntie Karan out of respect. And Uncle Sean, I don't call him Uncle Sean, but Sean. And I came back and she was like, I don't want tea. It hurt. I was like, this is very bad. Like, it's very rude. Like, in Afghanistan or the Afghan culture, you give someone food or tea, whatever, they don't say no. Even though if they don't want it, they drink it. It's good manners. So there was challenges. And then,
it's a bit like Irish culture. It's fine.
It's quite similar. Nice, yeah. And then afterwards, whenever I go, Sean makes tea. Whenever he's making tea for himself, he makes it for me. But we do ask Auntie Karen because she's just different. And we do ask if she wants tea. I absolutely had an amazing time. I think we were so different, but we learned a great deal from each other. And I think If I hadn't gone there, it would have been really hard for me, you know, to deal with life on my own and be stressful. It's just having family and just having love. And I realized, you know, there's so much, we have so much in common. Like, we're just humans, this idea of, even though he was infidel, you know, in my eyes, but I was like, nah, great, it can work. And he was non-believer, but it still worked. And I shared the home with them, you know, and I still feel part of the family. And it's great.
You mentioned that a couple of times, the fundamentalism, seeing other people as infidels. How did that change?
I think, I don't know, I have become more pragmatic and more, I saw the world from an outside now. I kind of think we have more in common. There's more similarity between us, the differences. I think because, I don't know, people are brainwashed. Like, for example, in Afghanistan, I had this very simplistic view about us and them. And this us and them is what is causing the problem. Mm. And it isn't. And I think we're both human beings. And the religion is just kind of a private thing for us. And whether we believe in God or not. And I think it's unfair to force it on others and to kind of say, you're wrong and I'm right. No, who gives us the right to say that?
Is that you being westernized?
Oh, this actually is a big debate about that amongst the Afghan community, thinking that I become westernized. But no, I think I haven't forgotten my roots and my principles. I still have my values of strong believers, in certain ideas. But say, for example, and I mentioned this in the book, I think as well, for example, gay is right, okay? Islamically, it's something that I can't accept. And for example, even gay marriage is really problematic for me. But I have no problem. I will not take any direct action against it. And I actually have friends who are gay. And it's kind of cool. Even though religion says no, but I'm not trying not to contradict religion, but trying to stay neutral and stay just be nice to everyone. I think it's nice to be nice.
Yeah, well, what about the role of women? Because that's been a big controversy in Afghanistan.
I was angry when my mom was making decision for me. I was like, I was supposed to be the one who make decisions, not you. I think, yeah.
You were only 12.
Yeah, of course. That's how I was brought up. I describe it as
Afghan 12 male is female 47 2 or
probably
something like that.
Yeah? But no, I was like, I felt like I was a home minister. No, I was in charge of the women. So my uncles literally gave me the certificate for basically bossing around the aunties and everyone else. And they could not go out without my permission. I was like the boss of the house, even when my uncle was around. Only my dad would just sometimes shout at me. Everyone else was like, great, Gulwali, keep it up. Someone needs to be the bad one in the house. I think it was just the issue about, you know, the culture and this honor. For example, my sister was going to school, and I didn't want I didn't want him to not to go to school. I want him to go to school.
The Taliban didn't want them to go
to
school.
Yeah, of course. And that was they were really extreme in their views. Islam says education is compulsory, and male and female, but then that's a different interpretation about what education, which kind of education. For me, it was just like this idea of having your sister going to school was really shameful. Like, you know, people tell me that, oh, Gulwali, I saw your sister, would be some shameful thing. And also, like in school, when we used to fight each other. Like, I was a good boy, I didn't really fight. But when there was a fight, people would mention their mother's name to each other, which was not a nice thing. Like, you don't want people to know you don't want people to know your mother name. You don't want people to know that they have seen your female relative. Just the society, the way things were. And I don't know how I have changed so much. It's just like my writer is a female, my publicist is a female, like the whole team I've been working with are female, and I'm like, sometimes I'm in the room with like six females, and I look at myself. Something has happened with me. Something has changed. And I think it's a positive change. It's a good change. And I'm grateful. I think women's are really kind, you know?
Depends on the woman, you know? Depends on the man, too. Over here? Yeah, let's take a mic.
I'm sorry to strike a discordant note.
That's fine. You're absolutely welcome. Yeah. Go for it.
But I'm just rather worried about the austerity agenda in the UK. I would disagree. It doesn't seem, according to the Conservative Party's perspective, that we are a rich country. And there is serious turbulence among people who've lived all their lives here, paid taxes for all their lives, that so many people, perhaps many unvetted, could contain perhaps ISIS members, and it is concerning. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to sort of make that comment.
No, it's a reasonable question. Many, many people across this public debate have raised that question, because if we bring in many, many refugees and asylum seekers, many who are undocumented, you were undocumented, you had to even prove your citizenship and nationality across a five-year period. How do we know who's coming in is the question people are asking.
I think that's a very valid point. I think we should be concerned. I'm not saying we shouldn't. But my understanding is, for example, the so-called Islamic State doesn't want people to leave their state. They want people to stay. But that's true. Maybe some people could get in through the refugees and come to Europe. There is a possibility. We need to be cautious.
Cautious, is that the word?
Cautious is good.
Cautious, yeah. We need to be careful. We need to take extra care when we're doing the, within the system. The system needs to be more effective. It has to investigate. It has to really go deep into, because like, the way that I was investigated, as kind of, I wasn't a terrorist, you know, but it's good to be vigilant and to look out. But majority of the people who are coming, they're escaping. You can see, you can actually feel they've been traumatized and they're running away. I don't personally think it's a bigger threat. I don't think ISIL members getting to Europe is a bigger threat. The bigger threat we have is radicalized youth in Britain and radicalized youth in Europe.
Trying to go there.
Trying to go there, but also who feel isolated, who doesn't feel part of society, who doesn't feel they treated as special. This whole notion I described in the book about how this gaming idea, notions of war and fighting is romantic. And I think we need to value our young people more. We should have more expectation. We should make young people aspirational, whether they're Muslims, non-Muslims, whomever. We just need to make sure that they feel that they're citizens of this country, they're valued. And I think that is more of a threat in my understanding, because I have friends who came with me because of the system and because of their troubles and because of their stress and depression. They have went the wrong direction. They ended up in prison. Mm-hmm. They ended up, you know, on drugs and selling drugs and doing the wrong things because they didn't get the support they needed. And I hope the government will do more. I think this argument is fair about, you know, wrong people getting in. But so does that mean we shouldn't welcome anyone? We shouldn't allow anyone? I mean, in the UK, doesn't allow anyone anyway, whether you are coming from Syria or Afghanistan. It's just the border is blocked. People get in. People just literally in Cali. About 20 people has been killed recently. 20 people have been killed so far in this year trying to get in the trains and been hit by the electrics and people have just gone through so much. They had to. Every person I saw in Cali, their hands are broken. They have scars everywhere, and I think it's sad. I don't know what could we do. What we could do is to treat them as humans. Just tell them like, you know. All of those people I saw, they wanted to be back in their country, but most of their homes were bombed in Syria. Most of their, like even in Afghanistan, things are really bad. Like after 15 years of the Western intervention, now we have ISIL in Afghanistan, which, you know, far worse than the Taliban. They're literally cutting people's heads up. Like there's no second thought. There's no second. Yeah, it's sad.
Crucifixions, all kinds of things. Yeah. Have you met many people in Britain who are on that radicalization journey?
I have actually met a few people who feel that Britain is responsible for a lot of wrongdoings in their countries, and Britain is not treating them well, and how there's their double standards, and people get angry about this Israeli-Palestine issue. People get really passionate about what's happening in Iraq and Syria. But because we haven't done enough to bring them into the mainstream society. For example, when I talk to young people, I say, look, get involved with the youth council, get involved with the school council, get involved with the UK Youth Parliament, do some charity work, do some community work. I have met the most amazing people through the things that I've been doing. You know, I have been privileged to advise the UK government, you know, to advise people like Michael Gove and youth policies. And it's been great for me to be in that position to work with British Youth Council. And there's huge opportunities for young people. They have a voice. And I think if we can bring them in somehow, encourage them to be empowered and to be valued active citizens.
Feel a sense of ownership.
Exactly,
society.
And we're very lucky. I think I go to school and talk to people like, don't take it for granted the opportunities that you have. And this thing was making me angry at school, that children and young people, some of them, just thought it was normal for them to go to school. I was like, not only the school, but there are a billion people who go to sleep without food.
Yeah.
And here we are, just take it for granted. I think we need to do more. And I feel like sense of duty, and that's why I have written the book, is to educate young people to be more aspirational, to appreciate the things that they have, appreciate their parents, appreciate their educations, and take every opportunity that they have to ensure they become not only a good citizen in Britain, but good citizen for the world. I think Britain have a huge role to play, and so does British people and those who are educated in Britain.
You can probably take one or maybe two, if you're really keen. There's John over there. Anybody on this side? Yes, we'll get to you as well. And while you're going there, can I just say, look, you got from the age of 12, 13 to what are you now, third year?
Third year university.
University student at the University of Manchester. My goodness, I mean, when you're making that journey and you're going through prisons in Turkey and places like that, you couldn't have imagined you'd be in your final year and an author.
I never thought this whole thing would happen. But things happen because I've been trying to do the right thing. And that's one of the messages to young people of mine is that, you know, if I can do it with this...
You can do it too.
Yeah, you can do better.
Yeah, I'm feeling like an underachiever here, yeah. John.
Yes, thank you very much for your inspirational story. I think I'd probably speak for most people in the audience. I have to say, I couldn't let go a comment that was made by the last speaker. While in the context of austerity, we can spend billions on Trident, I think that's an issue we need to keep in mind when we hear about we haven't enough money. The issue is political will, as you pointed out. But the question I wanted to ask you was, what would your advice be to everybody in this room tonight? What's the one thing you think we can do to help the refugee crisis?
Great, thank you so much. I think, yes, I mean, we always have money for military intervention in bombing up countries, which I don't want to become too political here.
We've lost that battle already.
And I think what you can all do is that, first of all, for you to come here and to listen, you know, to give you your time to listen to me. And I think, I don't think my story is inspirational or extraordinary. I think it is, it's a very ordinary story. There are more people who have extraordinary stories.
It really isn't.
Who have extraordinary stories, but they don't have the platform to tell it, or they don't want it to, because people feel, people doesn't want to be labeled as an asylum seekers or refugees. They want to be just want to be people and just want to be humans. So that's why they don't want to come out to tell their story. And for me to do this, I mean, I was reading the comments on The Guardian yesterday. It made me really upset. These comments I see on social media, it doesn't help. But what you guys could do is, there's many things you could do. One is to actively engage with the discussion that is happening and say, look, maybe challenge some of the narratives that some of the people are saying, saying, look, this is not true, this is the reality, this is being exaggerated, and this is let's put it in perspective. But also, as individuals, you know, as I mentioned before, we can write to our MPs, we can write to our Northern Ireland parliamentarians and assembly members, and like, for example, Northern Ireland said they will take 2,000, and there was a huge debate around it. I mean, yeah, so, and then one thing we could do is just show kindness when we see a newcomer. So when I came to Britain, one thing I saw the kindness of a lot of people, but just being treated as normal. You know, I don't want to be treated as special. I don't want to be treated as somewhat. I don't know. There is so much we could. There is only so much an individual can do, I think. Yeah. And it's just been normal, and just try, when you see someone who is lost, and just to help them. And if there's a protest or demonstrations, try to welcome more refugees or visit to Calais. Please, I think if you get the chance to visit Calais, I think it would be great. Please do. Because it makes, not only makes you realize how fortunate you are, but also makes you realize, you know, what we don't really hear, what we don't really see on the ground. And go and talk to people. If you get the opportunity, please do. Sorry, that was a politician answer.
All right. Yes, over there. I think that's the last one, unless anybody is really, really keen. And squeeze you in. If you are keen to ask a question, now is your last chance after this question. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. You kind of answered this in what you just said, but do you think telling individual stories is the best way to change people's perceptions, or do you think there are other ways to challenge maybe some of the stereotypes and prejudices that we do have?
Great. I think that is one of the reasons why I have written my story and I have shared it with the world, is that giving it a human face and saying, well, this happens to real people. It's not just what we hear in the media and what we see in the news, but it's literally real stories. And how would we feel if you were in this situation? I'm sure the people in the audience who have sons or daughters who are 12 years old, and how would you feel if you had to send them away to the unknown? And God forbid, I say this a lot, that if there was a war in Britain and people were migrating and becoming refugees, how we want to be treated? I think by having, you know, creating awareness and creating understandings and maybe challenging some of the views, but also doing more on the policy side. And one thing I hope to do is, like, not only inform people and educate them about the problems, but also maybe something will happen with the policy arena and the politicians make decisions to help people in those crises. I mean, like, for example, we can actually have a solution in Syria. It's not easy. It's easy said than done. But if you can bring Russia, China, and all those permanent security members to agree on a solution, it could be a solution. But the problem is, everyone sees their interests. No one really thinks about the Syrian people or the Afghans or the Iraqis. Everyone just thinks about their interests. And I think if public are more aware, public are more engaged, then the government will have to basically, like, for example, we have a very left-wing Labour Party leader now, and things could change and things will change. So just because of people power, and because I truly believe, you know, people having a voice and having a say really makes a difference.
Last chance. Yes, you got it. Well done.
Studying at Manchester University. What do you hope to do after that?
Good. Okay, I didn't say that. I study politics degree, social science and politics, my third year, which I don't know how I managed to get into third year. Now it's a challenge. And I hope to, when I finish studies, I hope to work for the UN Refugee Agency before I go to Afghanistan, before I get the experience to become a diplomat and politician. I think the refugee issue is a very urgent one, and it's a very immediate problem. And I think if I use my experiences and expertise as well as education,
and knowledge in the area, and to hopefully help those people and reduce their suffering and pain would be something that I feel really satisfied about. So I will do everything I can to go on and do whatever I can to be useful and to help those people who are suffering.
Let's thank the Lord.
Also, just a great big thank you to William, our host, as ever. We've done a great job. Thanks for being here.